You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. It's going to be another amazing stream. And I told Robert I was going to do an intro, which was going to be me ranting a little bit about the new censorship. What's going on YouTube is absolutely madness. That's not even a word. It's absolutely mad. It's absolute madness. For those of you who don't know, I didn't get the email, but apparently I've seen everybody else has gotten the email. It might be American channels more than Canadian channels. Apparently, there are certain things that YouTube will now no longer allow to be discussed on the platform, and video content on the subject will be removed. It'll be removed. And not that I ever thought I engaged in it in the first place. Maybe some videos we discussed these issues. I don't care whether or not I ever engaged in the issue discussion. It is outlandish that they say now they will remove the videos without penalizing the channel. As of inauguration, I believe they're going to actually, you know, the threat is to give channel strikes. Styx Hexenhammer had an interesting piece on it, Styx Hexenhammer 666, where he said, it's interesting, they seem to be changing their terms of service without changing their terms of service, and this is a blog post that they sent by email, but their terms of service haven't changed. So they, everyone can hear me, F, because I'm late, Bill V, yes. You know what, it actually, there's a lag before going live. They have announced that you cannot discuss certain issues that relate to the election and that bring up certain issues that some people have been raising with the election. They will remove the content from YouTube. It's not even a memory hole anymore, and it's not even subtle. It's overtly in your face. Now, these are not issues that discuss violence. They're not issues that discuss threats against individuals, doxing. These are not issues that are against the terms of service. This is a subject matter that they have now conveniently decided they're going to remove from the platform. And it's not even that much of an offensive subject matter. It's kind of the national discussion right now at the, whether or not they like it. There's tens of millions of people who are discussing it. And after, you know, 4 years of, if this discussion is now taboo, the last 4 years of the Russia issue probably should have been similar taboo, but obviously never was. Hold on. Did I just see something that came up right as I said that? After 4 years of hashtag not my president, how long before it and people who use it are banned on Twitter? It's a very interesting point. That's it. That's now the eggshells that we have to walk on. I have been gauging how other channels that are educational channels are dealing with this. I've been watching Tim Pool. Not only have his videos not been removed, they still seem to be monetized. He does discuss it in an educational, informative manner, and not as in one of promoting that which YouTube does not want us to discuss, not even promote, not even want us to discuss. Viva Fry, happy Sunday, brother. I watch you on YouTube, if not time to go to locals. Well, we're going to work around it in that we're not going to discuss the issues as the issues per se. This is going to be a crash course in constitutional law. For everyone's knowledge and edification, the interesting thing, YouTube don't have terms of service. They have editorial guidelines. Touche. Let me get into that thought in a second. I forgot the line. Oh, yeah. No, my joke was that now YouTube, there's another F word on YouTube. And it starts with F and it rhymes with Todd. This is the discussion now. How can YouTube possibly purport to be a platform and not exercising editorial control, much in the same way the New York Times exercises editorial control in the content that comes out on their platform? How can they argue it? They're getting to the point where they can't. And thank you very much, Slashed. Styx Hexenhammer, I wish I could borrow this, you know, make this knowledge or purport that it was mine, but Styx Hexenhammer had a very interesting theory. says, this isn't like poking the bear. This is like saying to everybody, we are now no longer acting like a platform, a content neutral platform. We are acting like an editorial board for YouTube. Come and remove our immunity under Section 230 CDA. And it's an interesting idea. It's almost as if YouTube is begging lawmakers to remove Section 230 Communication Decency Act immunity. That would be terrible for them, wouldn't it? It would open them up to lawsuits, lawsuits in defamation, like the New York Times faces, lawsuits in tortious interference with contracts, slander. I'm trying to think of some other easy ones off the top of my head. It would open them up to all the lawsuits that any newspaper would be open to. Why would YouTube do that? They make billions of dollars a year. They have all the lawyers in the world. They can probably deal with that for a little bit while every other smaller competitor goes bankrupt under the unbearable pressure of having lost the immunity that, you know, the entire internet had benefited from. So, you know, there's an idea that it could even be a strategic poking the bear, because if it penalizes everybody, that's fine. But, you know, giving everyone a $100 ticket doesn't affect the dude down the street the same way it affects Bill Gates, vice versa. So, you know, YouTube is sort of the Bill Gates of the internet. Start issuing fines, it's going to put the smaller people out of business before it's going to put a dent in the big people. So that's my rant. It's madness that they have selected a specific topic, which is itself not offensive, non-violent, non-destructive, non-doxing, nothing. And I'm a great American, thank you. And they've picked this topic, clearly a political topic, and they've restricted discussion to the point where they're going to go in and pull content, remove content from the platform if it doesn't abide by their new email blog, apparently. Why is anyone surprised? They have been moving in this direction for more than one full year. They don't want your content. You need to be moving on to greener pastures. Well, they have an exception. You know, their exception is drafted in such a way that it would seem, first of all, thank you very much, Mark. I didn't thank you. The exception seems to be drafted in a way that news, analysis, and education can discuss the issues, but not promote the theories, which is, you know, that's a great way just to stifle any form of discussion. I mean, I was talking about it with somebody else. I said, what's next? What next are they going to just decide they're going to remove from YouTube? There are any number of theories. There are any number of discussions out there that people have that tomorrow they can say, nope, can't have that on YouTube. Then YouTube has become a journal and not a platform. Okay. Do I have a Rumble page, Mr. Rover Pilot? Yes, I do. It's Viva Fry. I put everything there anyhow, and I put the live streams there. I'm going to start doing it instantaneously, or as soon as I have a buddy, Eric Hunley, who also has a channel called Eric Hunley, does interviews, and they're great. He has a podcast, Unstructured. He rips the video for me, and then I post the live streams to Rumble immediately afterwards. So let's see. That's where it goes. Rumble, Viva Fry, and I'm up to 40,000 subs there, and it's great. It's good. I'm going to use YouTube as long as it's useful for it. There's no reason to cut off your nose to spite your face. It's still the biggest playground, but man, are they doing it and making things look like they're going to head the MySpace way. Senator Lewis' statement about President-elect Trump. Forgive me for not reading it. I mean, I'm not going to read all these super chats or even comments that have these issues. Yeah, no, it's overt. It's in your face. It is thumbing your nose at the power that the largest search engine, which owns the largest video hosting platform, gets to, from one day to the next, decide on their own. Okay, with that intro rant, no, he does not. Eric has been helping me tremendously get the content onto Rumble and get the audio onto podcast as well. So we have a podcast. It's called Viva and Barnes Law for the People is the podcast. Rumble, I'm on Rumble. I'm not sure if Robert is just yet. And we have a locals page for anybody who wants to support. And there's some additional special content there. Everyone on locals gets sneak peeks of the videos as well. Mejui One, yes, thank you very much for the super chat. Do you think Rumble won't get in trouble with Canada's hate speech laws, etc.? No, I think they'll be good. I did an interview with the CEO, responsible guy, and he knows the politics of the game. When YouTube finishes, it will not be Viva and Barnes Law for the People. It will be Viva and Barnes Drone Fishing for the People. Yeah. It is. I say it is what it is in the most cynical of senses. Okay. On the evening, on the menu for the evening, we are talking about the constitutional issues that are currently going on that people don't seem to understand, starting with the Texas lawsuit dismissal. We're not going to get into the Texas lawsuit again because I did a breakdown of that Texas lawsuit. Just an analysis. Maybe I had some opinion in there at some point. That video was demonetized after 174,000 views because it's algorithmic. They just go in. They're not picking on me. They're not looking and say, Viva Fry, let's get that channel. They just go in and add words to the naughty list of the day. And they clearly added Texas lawsuit. So that video is performing exquisitely well. And you go when they demonetize it, the monetization is one thing. It kills the viewability of the video. So it's just now it'll be dead in the water. But that's the analysis of the lawsuit. The lawsuit was dismissed on standing. We're going to get into all of this because people don't understand. I myself am confused. And I pick Robert's brain and I pick Nate Brody's brain and I pick Kurt's brain on civil law. And some people are feeling vindicated because they predicted this, it would go this way. I know Robert is disappointed, but I know we all said standing was going to be the number one issue. I did think it deserved more than a 2-line judgment, but that's just because I'm emotionally invested. So we're going to talk about that, and we're going to go through all the constitutional stuff. What happens? What's next? What the possibilities are? What was I about to say? Super chats. I'm going to try to get to all of them. My apologies if I don't. It will happen. If you're going to feel miffed, don't give a super chat. I don't like people feeling slighted. Second thing, super chats. Robert and I split them, but YouTube takes 30%. So if that is a deterrent, and I understand it is for many, don't worry about it. It's just to show support. And we appreciate it. No legal advice. We answer some questions, but nothing in this stream should be construed as legal advice. I think that's it. Let's bring in Robert. 11 minutes in. Robert's looking good. He's smiling, which is always good to see. Robert, how you doing?
Good, good.
Okay, so I have my rant about the YouTube thing, but I mean, what, you know, let's just start with that. What are your thoughts on what they're doing? Are they deliberately asking for legislators to come in and say, you are acting like something that we did not give you immunity for? I mean, what do you think about what they're doing? What's it going to lead to?
Well, I mean, I think it's what they believe that Democrats want them to do, which is to censor and control and gatekeep information. That it's what big media wants them to do. It's what George Soros and others that are big potential stockholders wanted them to do. And they know the Republicans are all talk, no action. So they're not worried about Republicans doing anything because they know they won't. I mean, that's just realistic. I mean, for 4 years, these complaints have been raised. And for 4 years, all they've done is talk. You know, I mean, Senator Hawley has introduced some legislation. Cruz and Paul and some others have said stuff, but they have taken no meaningful action. And so while they face antitrust actions, Facebook now added to that list with Google with facing major antitrust actions that could have some potential consequence. There right now, their people are getting picked for high level positions of power if Biden is inaugurated on January 20th. So why would they be? They're more interested in placating that crowd than they are any Republican critics.
And that's what, we're paying attention to who's being picked. I lost a bet based on elections to a friend. And when I gave the $20 bill, I wrote on it, this is what I think is going to happen under a Biden presidency. The first thing I said was it's just going to be rampant tech censorship. And it's going to be remorseless because on the one hand, it's going to be seemingly virtuous for those who are imposing the censorship, and it's going to be consequence free. So it's going to be virtuous and with impunity, and it's going to get worse. It might kill Twitter. Like I do have a feeling Trump will be off Twitter in late January. So Twitter might go bust. It might become, it might become a vapid echo chamber. It looks like YouTube's going that way too, where literally they're building the echo chamber. They're building it through exclusion.
No doubt. The objective originally to surveil people is sort of being undermined by excluding people from the various means they would have otherwise used to surveil people. So I think that backfires to a certain degree. But I think it does increase the necessity to continue to utilize new platforms. That's why we created the Locals page in part, was to have something outside of Facebook, outside of Twitter, outside of YouTube, where content can be created, curated, and commented upon. And other ones like it, Parler and Rumble. I mean, you did a great interview with the Rumble guy. That was fascinating. That, you know, that's going to be a true, it looks like a free forum for YouTube type replacement. So meaningful competition might be able to happen, which would be great. And the antitrust claims will facilitate the rise of like Parler and Rumble and Locals. But people need to start supporting it and going to those places more and more, sharing it, getting involved in it, getting invested in it. Doesn't mean you have to abandon your current platforms. It's just go ahead and start developing your backups now. You want your backup plan before you need to use it, not after you need to use it.
I mean, that, and that is the reality. Rumble has been around for a while, but it has now become sort of the, I don't want to say the conservative platform, because it's not. It's had cat videos for 7 years. It's just that it is now where people are going because it's monetized for the creators, which is sustainable for the creators. Unlike BitChute, which is nice for backup, but it's not good for the creators. But it looks like it looks viable. I'm just bringing up cultural. Okay, a dumb question. Police can't circumvent the law by having ordinary citizens act as their agents. Could big tech be sued for being agents of the state? I mean, we've discussed
there's currently this, right? Actually a suit pending along those lines where they've found evidence of coordination. So the center, so Robert Kennedy's group is part of that, of bringing legal action to deal with that. And so where basically they're finding coordination between state governments and federal governments and Facebook and other social media trying to suppress dissident information. So that might be one of the better cases to bring, because that's what you have to show. There is a right to bring a civil conspiracy under 1881 that was designed to deal with the Klan in particular, that reaches civil rights violations where someone is effectively acting like a state agent. What it is all the courts to date, like we'll get into pretty soon, have been politically corrupted and deferential to big tech. I mean, is the reality. I mean, and there's a lot of areas where they've become defunct as a meaningful independent check on the abuse of power. But one of them has been big tech. So it's going to require continuous creative cross pressures of litigation and legal reform and political action, as well as independent entrepreneurial activity to really contest and fight these big monopolists and their new attempts to curtail and gatekeep speech and ideas.
What people don't really appreciate, I mean, I appreciated it in Canada, but they say like government's going to go and try to break up the big tech. They're trying it with some antitrust suits. But in Canada, you know, they can control which politicians get elected by, you know, not allowing certain politicians to advertise on Facebook, which sort of has an impact when you want to try to get reelected. And so it's sort of the ownership is the other way around now. It's not the government that has control over big tech. It's big tech that has control over government. And it's we're really, really seeing it in a meaningful way now. Okay, what do we do? Let's start with Texas. Let me just bring up a couple of super chats actually before we get into this. Less than a decade ago, Twitter exec appeared before Parliament and said, Twitter is the free speech wing of the referee speech party. What makes you think Locals, Parler, et cetera, won't go the same way? They might, but what's
because of who owns them. I mean, they've created an ownership structure different. That's why. So the and we'll see what, I mean, there's always risk that it's not that those people sell out at some point. That's just a risk of the situation. But to a certain degree, when your competitive edge is the fact that you provide free speech, there's going to be a market disincentive to try to go differently. And your interview with the Rumble founder was very good. We know the people who founded Parler. These are people who are not trying to make money off of it. I mean, Rumble, they're, you know, trying to do solid, but their goal isn't money making as much as it is to provide a real meaningful, to return the internet to its roots of being a platform that frees up speech and communication. That's definitely the case of the founders of Parler. And that's definitely the case in the founders of Locals. So you have the most reliable people you possibly could involved with the founding of those organizations and institutions. And so you might as well at least give them a try, at least have them available as a backup and start to utilize them more and more because they may become meaningful competitors to the big tech censors that want to control and gatekeep what you think, see, hear, and believe.
All right. And now I'm going to bring this up because Utreon has been, and I've been saying Ultreon the entire time, but Utreon is another video hosting platform. And he's been, first of all, very generous with the super chats, but it is good. It is good advertising, Utreon. Uncivil's on Utreon. Viva, let's get on this week. Okay. Utreon, email me again tomorrow or I'll email you and we'll figure this out. And for anybody who, you know, thinks cynically and says, Locals is behind a paywall, there is some content that is available for followers who don't necessarily support. There's some content that is exclusive for supporters. That's just a show thank you. And basically everyone on Locals just gets sneak peeks of my vlogs, and then the rest of the world gets them on
YouTube. Most of the content is still free. But if we're going to make these or place like Locals viable, there has to be a subscription component. It's $5 a month. So, you know, this is not earth shattering. But there needs to be that component. I mean, the idea that people are entitled to free stuff, this is what YouTube and Twitter has misled them into, because they don't realize with Locals, the difference between Locals and Twitter and the rest is Locals, you know what you're paying for, and you're not giving it in other ways without you knowing it. On Facebook, on Google, and everyone else, you're paying. You just don't realize you're paying, and you're paying, and you're giving a lot more than you're getting in return. You're giving a lot more than $5 worth. That's how these companies are worth so much. So why not have an honest transaction with a company that is protecting your privacy and protecting speech at the same time than to go otherwise? But I get some people are like, why are you doing anything behind any kind of firewall? It's because we need to provide real meaningful independent support for these independent groups. And part of that is going to be a subscription-based model. That's just the reality. Unless you want to be dependent on advertiser dollars or big tech. And if you don't want to be dependent on those two things, then you need to have money has to be there for these people to function.
And if anybody, I didn't truly fully appreciate it until I read the Google antitrust suit. For anybody who really wants to fully appreciate how much they own of you, even if you're not on the platforms, go read that suit or watch that video. Okay, and then last one before we get into the actual issues. If the Democrats take control of the White House, will the antitrust suits go anywhere? That's a good question.
Oh, that won't matter. They'll move forward. So the reason is because a bunch of the one good thing Barr did, frankly, maybe the only good thing it turned out he did, is that the state, and it wasn't really totally within his control, and this is probably a good bridge to the Texas suit.
Yeah.
A bunch of state attorney generals were going to bring that action no matter what the Department of Justice did. So the Department of Justice brought it along with them. The Justice Department now is not in a position to unilaterally dismiss. And I know some of those people that are in the Justice Department that are part of the antitrust division, they're committed antitrust people. So they're not either really Republican or Democrat. I mean, there's like people like Matt Stoller who does great antitrust work. He's on the left, but he's a deep, deep antitrust guy. And he's probably the best place you'll get for real insightful criticism of the nominees of Biden if Biden is inaugurated, because he'll give you eviscerating criticism of some of these neoliberal corporatists. Those suits will march on. And my guess from reading them and reviewing them, we may get to Facebook a little bit later, but they have a very good chance to succeed.
Okay, now let's start with this. Van Cobra, this was the moral of the social dilemma. If you're not paying for a product, you are the product. And if you really watch the social dilemma to fully appreciate that, but read the Google antitrust suit or watch my vlog on it if you want to have someone read it to you at hyperspeed. Okay, thank you very much for the super chat. And now, let's do this. What time? 22:43, Texas. Without going back over the suit, the lawsuit was Texas suing four other states directly to the Supreme Court under the original jurisdiction premise. The lawsuit was Texas suing Pennsylvania, Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan, alleging that a number of things, factual things, but also legal questions about whether or not their election laws were unconstitutionally modified. So, and whether or not in so doing, did it cause problems? So that is as much of the factual basis that we need to walk on eggshells on YouTube. The issue, and like I mentioned in my vlog, and as much as I understood it, standing was going to be the issue. How can one state sue another state for their own state laws? The argument that Texas raised in their brief was that there's the Elector's Clause in the Constitution, and that determines how states govern themselves to appoint electors to effectively nominate the president. These four states, in having done so through what are arguably unconstitutional laws, have basically diluted Texas's votes in that they follow the laws, and now their votes are going to be sort of diluted or contradicted by the results in these states that are now abiding by or reaping the fruits of unconstitutional laws. They sue in SCOTUS. SCOTUS dismisses in a two-liner on standing. So I guess first question, the Elector's Clause in the Constitution, do you want to give everyone a briefer, an explanation, and maybe a history as much as you can recite offhand?
Sure. So the Texas State claim was the best possible claim that could be brought. They did a very good job of keeping it under wraps. Democrats were completely sideswiped by it. The states involved were completely sideswiped by it. They wrote, in my view, you know, pretty poor. The Democrats never even intervened because Mark Elias didn't have a prepared brief in response to this. And then he should have, but he didn't. And then the Democratic states had an over the top reaction that, in my view, wasn't really even really well that well argued or articulated. Not only that, it was such a politically strategically smart suit that they got 20 attorney generals to join them, representing over 100 million citizens. They got public interest groups that are well respected, representing 75 million voters, intervene in the case. The president's also intervened in the case, and notably, he was on the same page as this. You put it this way, without disclosing any details, you could reasonably infer from the fact that the Texas brief was exceptionally well crafted and exceptionally well briefed that had been in motion for quite some time. You can also reasonably infer that the president was part of it because his constitutional lawyer filed something within a day that was also exceptionally well done and well briefed. And that doesn't happen in 10 hours. So it was the best possible argument, because going in, the big question was, one, would the Supreme Court get involved? And there were two schools of thought. One was that, well, they got involved in the South Carolina case and they were 4-4 on one of the Pennsylvania cases. And with Barrett's addition, Barrett was part of Bush v. Gore and was pitched to Trump and others that she would be good on election cases, that she would not be scared to get involved. And that she sort of made a name to fame in part in Republican circles by being part of Bush v. Gore, as well as being a Scalia clerk. And so that she would be there. There was a second school of thought that said if they weren't going to get involved prior to the election, they're definitely not going to get involved after the election, that they have chosen to not get involved in this election for whatever reason one may infer. And we can get into some of that. Well, we got the answer, unfortunately, on that. This was as good a case as could possibly be brought in terms of, particularly because of how many people joined it. It's not just Texas. You're talking about 20 attorney generals representing almost every attorney general. In fact, we'll get into the one who wasn't there, but almost every attorney general of any Trump state that was Republican supported the case. And, you know, they're not going to support it based on a frivolous argument. They're not going to risk their reputations and legacies and careers for some gibberish. And it's why Professor Dershowitz, whose highest form of praise for any legal argument is to call it creative, called it very creative as part of it. He thought it was still a Hail Mary because he thought the Supreme Court just won't come to Trump's defense. But he sees that as a political decision, not a legal one. And so it was a brilliantly done, brilliantly crafted decision. They got wide-scale, widespread support. They completely ambushed the other side, who wasn't ready or prepared to answer it or respond. And it was all just based on one big gamble. Would the Supreme Court step up to the plate or not? And ultimately the answer was, they're going to hide and dodge and hide under their tables. And so, you know, there was some evidence that that was where they were going to go based on their complete abject failure to meaningfully do anything prior to the election outside of one case, which was in a state that didn't matter. But, you know, now we know just how bad it is. And particularly, the fact that all three Trump appointees hid. Speaks volumes. And it's probably not a coincidence that the man they really thank for their position, Mitch McConnell, the only attorney general who did not appear in defense of these arguments from a Trump state that was a Republican attorney general, was Mitch McConnell's protege, Daniel Cameron, in Kentucky. I got some criticism previously for pointing out Cameron's connections to McConnell and the way he handled the Breonna Taylor case. But now you get to see egregious examples of it. And, you know, why wasn't he there? Why wasn't he involved? What was it what did that signal to everybody that he wasn't? Why has Mitch McConnell been so quiet? This is what happens when we appoint Federalist Society Supreme Court justices that stab Trump in the back the moment they get the chance. And that's what happened.
Okay, but now, so I'm going to present the arguments that I've been hearing all week. People are going to say, Robert, you're salty, as the expression goes, because you probably had a significant amount of work tied up in there as well, emotional investment, intellectual investment, but it was obvious. Why would the Supreme Court What standing would Texas have to tell Pennsylvania that their laws are unconstitutional? Or if they want to do that, go to a Pennsylvania state court and don't ask SCOTUS to adjudicate on that issue. A lot of people think it was obvious from the get-go. And I just want, I want people to appreciate the two arguments.
Oh, sure.
Go for it. Go for it.
So a couple of things. One is, I'll get to standing. My own view, and I've said this in a wide range of contexts, anytime a lawyer tells me to take standing seriously, I never take that lawyer seriously ever again. And that's because of the history of standing, which we'll get into. But the key component here that was unique, it was extraordinary. A wide range of commentary seemed to completely ignore the Elector's Clause. That this was not a situation of Texas suing Pennsylvania to deal with how Pennsylvania elected their state legislature. It was not Texas suing Pennsylvania about how they do pot laws. You know, those were the kind of cases that were leading the Supreme Court to find excuses not to take original jurisdiction, which we can get to that as a separate matter.
Yep, absolutely.
But out front, the Elector, what made this case unique is that first, procedurally, it was an original jurisdiction case. The Supreme Court, the Constitution was set up so that if the state is a party between the states, that the cases should go to the U.S. Supreme Court as the trial court. And it was the place of resolution. And so that gave a unique capacity to go around the rest of the courts and get quick, you know, one way or the other, get quick approval or denial. Let's know now, are you in the game or are you out of the game?
And let me tell you,
the easiest one for the Supremes to take.
Some people were saying that it would have to go, that it's a state issue, so that, you know, only the state courts can deal with it. My response was, Supreme Court nonetheless can interpret state law when the question is brought up to it, if it's of significant importance. So,
well, and not only that, under the Constitution, they're the only court that has jurisdiction. So if there's a dispute between the states, state courts don't have jurisdiction. No other federal court has jurisdiction. They have not only original jurisdiction, it's original and exclusive jurisdiction. So no other court can hear this case. So the only the Supreme Court could hear it. And then that's what gave it its particular capability. Was it provided the quickest and easiest opportunity to get a yes or no from the Supreme Court, whether they were going to get involved or not. And it was the easiest kind of case for them to take because they don't have to reverse or review anyone else's decision. And they can be the original court to hear evidence. And in addition to that, because of the original jurisdiction, they have authority to take it. And as Thomas, I think, correctly pointed out with Alito, he's brought Alito along in dissent. They have to take cases of original jurisdiction, and that these courts now, the problem has always been this. What if they don't? The problem with giving the Supreme Court the exclusive and original jurisdiction without any place to appeal to is that what if they just say, screw it, we're just going to ignore the fact that we have original jurisdiction and claim we don't. Unfortunately, there's no remedy there.
Well, so I want to make sure people appreciate also the distinction where standing might be an issue where it is, like you said, not a case of Texas just telling Pennsylvania to adjudicate on an internal law that is only affecting Pennsylvanians, speed limit, building codes or whatever. The argument, that's the way people wrote it off. They said standing, Texas has no standing to get involved in Pennsylvania laws, period. As if all laws within the state of Pennsylvania are limited in their impact only to Pennsylvania. Tim Pool had an analogy, and I forget what it was, but basically the idea here is you have multiple tenants in a building, and some of them are behaving in a way that's going to get everyone, that's going to affect everybody's peaceable enjoyment of that building. That's more the analogy with respect to the specific laws that they were challenging. They were not going after, you know, illegalized pot in Colorado. They were saying Colorado has done something that's going to affect us as a state in a consequence, and therefore we have standing in that we have suffered an injury in fact, in that it's going to dilute our legit votes, which follow the law, compared to those which allegedly didn't. And so that's the distinction in terms of the laws that were being challenged. This was not just challenging a simple local state law, as the argument would go. Supreme Court says no mas, no interest.
Yeah, and that's so the first part is original jurisdiction shouldn't even involve a standing issue. They should take jurisdiction and then hear it on the issue of whether they think standing exists. I'll get to that being just a made up doctrine, but that should have been the first step. So the fact that it was original jurisdiction, that, you know, Thomas is correct about that, and Alito has joined Thomas now. The fact that none of the originalists on the Supreme Court appointed by Trump joined him tells you how originalist they are. the give me an originalist interpretation that says a Supreme Court does not have to take original jurisdiction over a case that they're given original and exclusive jurisdiction.
And just
no originalist argument for that.
Just so everyone appreciates, the original jurisdiction clause in the Constitution literally says, among other things, when a state is a party to a lawsuit, the Supreme Court has exclusive jurisdiction and not appellate jurisdiction. It literally says it verbatim. So
yes, exactly. I mean, there's no doubt. That's where, I mean, Thomas is the only justice closest to originalism up there is Thomas. And he really tries hard to get there. The rest of them are not originalists. They never were. They're selective originalists for when it's convenient. Now, the second big problem was all these people were reading the Elector's Clause as if it didn't read what it said. If the Elector's Clause said the state, in its own discretion, may select electors however they choose, then they would have an argument that there has not been, in fact, a violation of the Elector's Clause. That should be the standard, not standing, which I'll get to. And then that would be the argument for these other states. Hey, Texas can't claim an injury, can't claim even a breach. They may be able to claim an injury, but they can't claim a breach because it gave us full discretion. That's what everybody was acting like. I saw these people making commentary. Oh, this is states' rights issues, da, da, da. Tell Al Gore about states' rights issues, Bush v. Gore. So I want to hear people defend Bush v. Gore and defend this decision because you can't defend both, particularly the concurrence of Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas in that decision. But putting that aside, the Elector's Clause instead said the state can only pick electors as the state legislature directs. That is, as Thomas and Gorsuch just recently wrote in the Faithless Electors case, that's previously in the term limits cases, that's an obligation, not an empowerment. It's an obligation. It's you as a state shall do electors in this way and send electors in this way. And what's critical behind all of this was it's like the entire constitutional compact got forgot. This was an agreement amongst sovereign states. And if the parties to the contract can't enforce a breach of their own contract, then nobody can, and you don't have a contract. If a contract's not binding, it's not a contract. It's a piece of paper. It's a piece of parchment in the National Archives to look at. It's like the Soviet Constitution was a great constitution on paper. So the whole point of it, the most logical people to sue were always the states for a violation of the Elector's Clause. And for folks out there, by the way, courts have said candidates don't have standing, voters don't have. They say nobody has standing to enforce the Elector's Clause right now.
Don't get there yet, because I want to get to that. That's the part where just you want to pull out your own hair. JD, I read the I'm just answering JD's comment here. I read the clause to the end, and it does say the appellate review, but it specifically says in the beginning, it says something about having original jurisdiction over ambassador issues and lawsuits where a state is a party. Original jurisdiction, so you don't have to go through the appellate court.
Makes sense. Why would you want a dispute between the states to be resolved in either state's courts? That makes no sense. So, of course, it would be resolved in a federal court, and they decided it's not trustworthy to have it within a federal court within that state. So it needs to be the Supreme Court. So basically, all the states got together, gave up certain rights in exchange for certain remedies. And by the way, as the Supreme Court admitted just 2 years ago in the Faithless Electors case, this was the number one issue of dispute or controversy at the Constitutional Convention. The number one issue of dispute was, how do we pick the presidency? Because this was the only office that was going to regulate and govern everybody as a singular person. So states were paranoid about how this office was going to be picked. They're also worried about them getting manipulated by foreign powers, by monarchical interest, by a wide range of concerns. So it was like, how are we going to make sure that we don't lose all of our rights overnight because we pick a bad president? So it was, okay, we're going to pick the one body that is the most responsive to the public within each state. It's only going to be the legislature that can decide. Nobody else gets to have any role. Executive doesn't get to decide. Local government doesn't get to decide. And it was all about qualified voting because the state legislatures had different standards for who could vote. And they're like, if you're going to submit this to the vote, you, the state legislature, the closest to the people, the most democratic state institution, has to be the exclusive body deciding it. And that's why the clause doesn't say the state may choose. It says the state, by a method chosen by the state legislature may choose. And that provision makes no sense if you can't sue about it, if you're one of the contracting parties originally to the case. So that's why I thought it was the strongest potential claim. And I haven't seen a refutation to that. I've seen generic arguments about standing that just skip over the electoral clause provision and that get to other cases involving other fact patterns. And so like Ben Shapiro was saying, oh, you can't take this case because it will mean every state can sue every state. No, it doesn't. Every case is not an electors clause case. This is a very unique issue.
And that is where the oversimplification to the point of distortion is to say state rights. And I see people saying this. I'm a very much a states rights person, so I sort of like, you know, the SCOTUS's decision. That is if you view the laws that were being challenged as being purely state laws that only impacted the states and not ones that were based on a provision of the Constitution, which is the contract between all of the states. So this is not between the legislature and the citizens of a state. This is among the signatories to the Constitution itself. I understood their decision. I think it's wrong, but above all else, it's wrong in that it's not justified or motivated. If they were going to say this is a states' rights issue, they needed to explain it and they needed to explain how they got there, and they didn't. And they didn't even and some people are saying, because it's such a stupid question, it's not even dignified. It shouldn't even be dignified with an answer. Hogwash. Because if they're gonna say that this is purely a states' rights issue, interpreting the Electors Clause of the Constitution, they needed to explain it because people need that explanation. And the absence of an explanation is no explanation.
No doubt about it. And then last, the fact they relied upon standing is always hogwash. The standing, tell me, I want these textualists and these originalists to show me where is standing in the Constitution. Show me where they were debating standing at the Constitutional Convention. Show me where they were debating standing during the constitutional ratification. Show me any case in the first 140 years of our jurisprudence where we ever talk about standing. We invented standing in the 1920s because our lazy courts didn't like their docket being so busy. And then they started to realize this is a wonderful political tool we can use. And so problem one with standing is it doesn't exist in the Constitution. The only question is there a case or a controversy? Not is there standing. The second problem is look at it historically. It doesn't appear anywhere in the record, either in the Constitutional Convention, the ratification debates, or the first century plus of our legal history. And then third, look at how it's actually been applied. So I put up on the locals board just one article, law review article, that looked at every Supreme Court case of standing. And they said it's one of the most politically manipulated, disparate, discriminatory doctrines that exist, aside from it being a jumbled mess of law. And it's a jumbled mess of law because it's bogus. Standing is what I call one of the many Pontius Pilate tools the courts have. So whenever the courts want to get together and say, man, I really don't want to crucify Jesus, but I got to wash my hands of this because my wife really doesn't like the guy. That what they do is they come up with a doctrine like standing is their favorite one. They have others, ripeness, mootness, latches, whatever else they want to throw in there. But standing is their favorite one. It's a made up doctrine. Don't take my word for it. Legal historians have called it fabricated. Legal historians have called it invented. Legal historians have said nobody. In fact, this is a quote from one of the leading legal historians. No one believes the doctrine of standing has any root in what the founders were thinking of when they put cases and controversies in the Constitution. So standing is just gibberish. It's a Pontius Pilate move to be, and it's preferentially applied. And here's my other argument against standing. Find me any case, any court, any judge, and chances are I can find an example where they've contradicted themselves on standing, where they found the almost identical fact pattern, just different politics, and voila, suddenly standing is there.
Well, I mean, look, we don't need to look much further than the mandamus in the Court of Appeals, you know, given to Hillary and not to Flynn. But I may disagree with you on the standing issue, because I know you think, you say standing is a fabricated issue or fabricated concept. And in my humble, you know, view, it's a fundamental concept. It's if you don't have any interest in a suit, you can't bring a suit just for the sake of it. Now, I don't know if you mean specifically.
You're talking about really is cause of action. That's what that analysis should be. In other words, did you have a breach? Were you a party to the contract, for example?
Did you suffer harm?
Did you suffer an injury or not? But that's not the analysis they're doing with standing, because if they had done that analysis, hey, do you state a claim? First, they have to take the case and then adjudicate a motion to dismiss. But secondly, they would have to say things that people would be like, that sounds ridiculous. So I, as a voter in Texas, was not harmed by these other states breaking the rules and electing somebody else president. That doesn't sound right. And isn't voter dilution? And here's last point on standing. Two subcomponents to it. People say, oh, the courts don't like to get involved in politics. Hogwash. There's only been two prior Supreme Court cases that could possibly or involve the Supreme Court in a presidential election. They jumped to get involved both times, 1876 and 2000. Secondly, and courts, in fact, get involved in politics all the time. But if you want to see how ludicrous their standing doctrines will be about voter dilution, because what the Supreme Court is doing, a bunch of other courts are doing, they're saying now you can't bring a voter dilution claim, unless you just can't. That's what they're saying as an individual. They're saying states can't do it on their behalf. Individuals can't do it on their individual's behalf. Campaigns can't do it on a campaign behalf. Go back and read Baker v. Carr and read how, because the Supreme Court gladly went in and dictated to states how they could apportion their own state legislative districts. They started out in Tennessee, so that's why I know that history. But so hold on a second. So it's states' rights unless it's state level apportionment, and then the U.S. Supreme Court has standing. And by the way, who sued? Just voters sued. Random voters. They didn't have any individualized, particularized injury of the kind they're talking about now. So they have a completely hypocritical set of doctrines in the whenever they want to get involved. That's why I say I can't take standing seriously. Seriously an analysis of whether you have an injury within a cause of action, but that's not standing. That's your old classic cause of action. You either proved a breach or you didn't. You either proved an injury or you didn't, so forth.
And it's an interesting distinction that I hadn't verbalized properly in my own head, because when I think of standing, it's true. I think of, is your action prescribed? Did you wait too long? Are you a party to the contract under which you're suing? That still requires an adjudication on the merits of the dispute, right, to some extent. Here, what they said, which is why I feel sort of totally unsatisfied and I feel robbed from a judicial perspective, there was no even addressing the merits, even on the merits of why they would dismiss it for lack of standing on the substance of the standing. They just said, we're not even considering anything here. So
that's where legal and political scholars basically have said standing is one of the doctrines whereby the courts limit their own power because they want to limit their use of political capital and don't want to expend it too risky in certain circumstances and situations. So it's always a purely political decision whenever standing comes into the play. And it's because of its disparate and discriminatory application, its lack of historical roots, its lack of contextual text, that people like me are harshly critical of it, because I just don't see that's a place for the courts to be. A court should not be voluntarily limiting who has it. What it really does is limits judicial accountability and limits judicial accessibility. And I thought one of the best videos on this, while they were not getting into the weeds of the law, was on a YouTube show, The Gaggle, with George Samueli and Peter Lavelle. And what's interesting about their perspective is they're both familiar with America, but live now outside of America. So they have a sort of clarity of vision. And what they were saying was, look, with all these people concerned with this big issue, isn't the great Supreme Court the elders of the country that should help resolve the issue either way, so that people feel comfortable that, hey, this is the institution we have, and the institution stepped into the breach, and the institution answered the question, even if we don't like their answer, like Bush v. Gore, some didn't like the answer. There was a federal court in Wisconsin that took the case, said standing did exist for a candidate, and explained why he didn't think this was a meaningful electoral college violation, what Wisconsin did. I disagree with it, but at least he's taken the case. And they were like, if the Supreme Court hides under the table, and that's how the ordinary person is going to see it, because that's the other problem with these doctrines. These doctrines are useful for limiting your political capital as it relates to other branches of power. It's counterproductive for public persuasion, because the ordinary person here standing and they're like, what? What is that crap? They know right away, oh, you're just hiding behind a fig leaf. This is when mommy and daddy give a bad answer to the kid. Kid's like, that's not the reason you did that.
This is part of the problem, actually. This is really the nail on the head, is half of the people are going to not understand the standing dismissal or why it is eternal truth. Number four, why standing is hogwash, and at least why this decision is hogwash. All they're going to say is, from their political blinder perspective, dismissed. It was totally meritless, and it was dismissed even though they never got into the merits. The other half are going to say, this is political nonsense. Sorry, I'm choking my tongue. We get told we're too early because there's no injury. So no standing because no injury. We wait, and then we're told, latches, you waited too long. No standing, dismissed because you waited too long. Now they're saying, states' rights issues, so you can't get involved. On the states' rights issue itself, it was in Pennsylvania. One of the Trump suits got dismissed because they said, you can't prove that you suffered any injury in fact. And so half of the people who, this pleases them politically, just run with it. It's a 40th lawsuit dismissed because they're so frivolous. And the other 75 million are saying, we can't get our day in court, literally.
It's courts that have forgotten what their role is. Because at the end of the day, the court's only power is the public belief in their authority, the public belief in their integrity, the public belief that they will intermediate disputes exactly like this based on objective principle and neutral dispatch. What the Supreme Court reminded everybody is, oh, no, that's just always been an illusion. We're just political actors operating from a position of power, and we'll screw you if we want to. We'll help you if we want to, but it won't be based on principle. And the biggest problem is the way in which they did this discredited themselves. The big losers in all of this so far, the judiciary, because there was a way in which they could, just as the executive officials could have done audits of the machines, audits of the signature matches, publish the ballots. I mean, they have all the ballots scanned. They could publish them to the world so people could see them and at least resolve certain controversies. Just as they've brought further discredit onto our elections by not doing that, the courts have suffered the worst. And they don't realize it. They don't, because they're such an insular echo chamber, they don't understand. Doctrines like standing sound like complete BS to the ordinary person. Same with mootness and latches and certain forms of immunity and all of these judicially engrafted doctrines. They work to protect people in other positions of the other branches of power, but they do not restore faith and confidence in the public. And that the part that shocked me was when you get a case that 20 attorney generals representing 100 million Americans and suits representing 75 million Americans, including by the president of the United States, join. And your reaction is to be just dismissive. That's a sign of how, people who are celebrating it. I was like, you're celebrating arrogance. You're celebrating insolence. You're celebrating insularity. This is not good. If I was on that side of the aisle, I would have wanted them to take the case and then dismissed it on the merits on the grounds that it wasn't really an Electoral College violation or there wasn't proof of fraud or something like that. I would want a Supreme Court stamp of approval for my position. As someone who just believes in the court's capability, its possibility, and the constitutional roadmap that I thought was quite brilliant in the way we set things up, to see them completely scrap that roadmap and not step into the breach is a very tragic and sad day for those of us who believe that the court has a meaningful role in American life.
And, I would like everyone to appreciate it because I'm close to both sides of the argument. Nate Brody put out a video Thursday of last week saying, this is a no-brainer. This is a state law issue. Supreme Court has no business intervening, and Texas has no interest in intervening. I don't care. From what I know, I still think that is a superficial way of looking at the specific issue. This is not purely a state law question. This is one that relates to the Constitution of interstates, and SCOTUS is the only entity that has interest that has the authority to adjudicate.
I mean, especially moral authority. I mean, now we're left with a political break. I mean, all the courts basically educated people on something I've been dealing with for 20 years. So the courts have, when people say courts don't like to intervene, they intervene all the time. They just intervene on one side. They intervene on the side of power against the little guy disproportionately. So I've been listening to these crazy standing latches, mootness, ripeness arguments now for 20 years. And they're using it as an excuse for some little guy just wants to get on the ballot. Some small independent candidate like I represented in Virginia who just was trying to get on one ballot, and somehow all the rules had to be strictly enforced against him, and the courts rushed to the rescue of the state to keep that dangerous person off the ballot, but for the suits that we brought. And so they don't understand these doctrines never sell well. And now they're like, they're just as the high ranking FBI and the national security establishment and the deep state kind of apparatus, educated old school law abiding military vet, police officer, Republicans, that the highest ranking law enforcement, military and political structures in our country are institutionally both corrupt and incompetent. Now the Supreme Court has let them know. So, oh, by the way, we're a bunch of cowards. We're some of the biggest cowards in the room. When the shots get fired, we're throwing grandma out the door first. You know, it was not an endorsement of their moral courage. That's for sure.
No, and what I'm now truly appreciating in terms of your level of frustration over all of this is the investment that you've had, the intellectual and emotional investment in this, to see the substance, the merits of the Texas lawsuit have never seen the light of day. And right, there were serious allegations in there. People think that it's been dismissed because it was so frivolous. They had their opportunity to show facts. They never got to the facts or the allegations of that lawsuit. And the court did not even explain why, in virtue of what, they were substantively denying Texas its day in court, if only for the court to say, this really is a state's rights issue. These, you know, the election laws in every state, it's up to them and them only. And if they're unconstitutional, let them, you know, write that in a decision that's going to last and that's going to assure the
public. Honestly address the facts, honestly address the law, and a meaningful, at least make sure the Elector's Clause means something. Because if it doesn't, because at this point it means nothing. At this point, this provision we had means, hey, if you as a state want to steal it, go steal it. Just as long as you can find a way to steal it, steal it. Because the one limitation they had was the only way you could rig an election for the presidency was you had to get control of the state legislatures. And the problems the Democrats had was in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, all the state legislatures were Republican. So that they couldn't go through the state legislatures to get what they wanted. And so they circumvented it. Well, the Elector's Clause says you can't do that, but all the courts are saying, nah, nah, nah. You know, that was just, you know, and that's why they can't honestly say that. That's why they look for other pretexts. Oh, you don't have standing. Oh, it's latches. Oh, you should have sued sooner. Oh, you should have sued later. All of these kind of things. And it's, well, I don't think the courts understand, as someone who is an idealistic at heart about the courts, they're discrediting these institutions, right? The rest of the world sees America as the rule of law country. So to see the U.S. Supreme Court dodge all of the controversies about a U.S. election that involved almost every state to the union asking them to take the case or address the case in some form or another is embarrassing. Our courts look worse than foreign courts do. I mean, the foreign countries look down on their courts as politically contaminated and corrupted. They're like, man, nothing like America. And in America, the Supreme Court's scared to even take up a case involving the presidential election, even when half the country is asking them to take it up.
Yeah, that's what I just couldn't get over the fact that it was treated so cavalier, and the two-liner is not a sign of strength. It's not a sign of weakness of the argument. It's not a sign of strength of their judgment. It is, like someone said, celebrating cowardice. It is just saying, we don't even want to get into it. Half the people are going to be happy. Half of them are going to be unhappy. And I'll say from my perspective, the half that are going to be happy should be unhappy, but politics, I'm not wearing that shirt today. Politics is what it is. Okay, so hold on. So the and that's, I guess, what do we want to talk? The Elector's Clause. The Elector's Clause. I guess you need to explain that so that people can maybe understand why this was not purely a state. Sure.
So they went around and around. How do we pick the presidency? Because fundamentally, the Constitution is a bunch of states getting together, giving up their sovereignty as states, as separate individual sovereigns. So think of us as like a bunch of countries in Europe creating a European Union. That's what the United States of America was. That's why it's the United States of America, not United America, not United Americans. And the only risk was, like, they had all the states were going to elect their own House members, elect their own senators. The only real risk was the presidency. That was, and people should remember, there was no office like that. I mean we come from centuries of royal rule. So the idea of an office like the presidency, we're accustomed to it. They weren't at the time of the founding. This was creating something totally new, and they were worried about all the risks of giving any such huge power to one man. That was the great fear, that somebody would declare themselves king, that someone would be co-opted by the monarchies of Europe, and so forth. I mean, that's where the emoluments clause comes from. It comes from fear of the royal families buying off officials in the government. And so they went around and they thought maybe we give it directly to the people. Maybe we do a national vote. Maybe we do it by district. Maybe we just let the states do it any way they want. Maybe we give it to the governors. Maybe we give it to the legislators. Who do we give it to? And they went around and around and around and around. It was the most divisive. It was the most debated. And so this was the key component to the contract between the states was, okay, your state legislature in each state is the only one that can pick the presidency. That's it. Nobody else can have any role. So they deliberately, and so what happens when that doesn't happen? What happens when the state executive branch decides they're going to pick effectively the presidency by changing the rules of the vote? What happens when the state judiciary decides they're going to change, they're going to choose the president by how they change the rules of voting? And by the way, the reason they chose the state legislatures in part was because different states had different rules about who qualified to vote. And they wanted the state legislatures to be making that decision, not only about electors, but if they decided to give it to a direct vote, who was qualified for that vote. And so this was deeply embedded in our founding. Now, it's one of the least adjudicated clauses in the entire Constitution. There are only 30 cases that address it in any capacity. Only two really head on, one in 1892 and the other, the concurring opinion of Scalia, Rehnquist, and Thomas in 2000. And what they said was that they suggested that states would have standing, but they suggested that there would be standing for a wide range of people because of the Elector's Clause, because and of other provisions too. But the Elector's Clause is one of the main ones they cited. In fact, the first key question in Bush v. Gore was, did the state judiciary violate the Elector's Clause by changing the rules of how votes were counted? So that's why people who initiated this and, you know, strategized this and brought this up saw a whole bunch of law that supported it. But the great backup was, well, at least this will give the Supreme Court an opportunity to step in. And even if they don't rule for Trump, at least our constitutional system stays steady. It will gain the confidence of not everybody, but at least a good portion of the Trump vote. Well, we got our day in court. Don't like the outcome, but at least the process is still strong. And it would establish a roadmap for future controversies and future disputes. By completely abandoning their obligations, by, in my view, abandoning their oaths, they have embarrassed the Supreme Court as much as they've embarrassed anybody. And the institution and credibility of the judiciary, I believe, is damaged in ways that it may never recover from for large numbers of people.
I mean, okay, this is, you know, James McCann asked the question, who enforces the Elector's Clause of the Constitution? Should Texas et al. Sue the federal government's Elector's Clause Enforcement Division for dereliction of duty? This is the other question is, the lawsuit didn't answer anything. So what does Texas go sue on the exact same basis, but sue in each state? In each state, would that be a solution to standing?
It can't. Then they'll be dismissed for because the Supreme Court has exclusive jurisdiction of a dispute between the states. So all the states have nowhere to go. They had one shot only. And that was part of the reason why it was procedurally strong. If you had a Supreme Court that was willing to listen. Now, if you had a Supreme Court that wasn't willing to listen, nothing you did was going to change their opinion. But what you wanted to do was to give them the best possible case if they were open to it. The fact that that the three Trump justices went out of their way to not even dissent was a message that they were going to do nothing to help Trump. And to be frank, that's not there's been, you know, Federalist Society is who really put them there. They don't really thank Trump for it. Put it this way. No Republican justice would have had the courage to do that to a Bush, and no Democratic justice. If the roles were reversed and we just changed the name from Trump to Obama, all the same facts in place, I guarantee you every Democratic justice steps up to the plate.
That was another question that came up in the super chat. A number of people are asking, cannot Trump himself or the campaign basically file the Texas suit to the Supreme Court?
Well, he actually did that beforehand. I mean, he filed suit in Pennsylvania beforehand, and they said, oh, you don't have standing. And then he filed afterwards, and they also said he didn't have standing. By the way, that was a Trump judge that said that, and a Trump judge of Trump appointee in the Third Circuit who said it. I mean, I'll get to the institutional problem of why really Trump is facing obstacles. It's too little support in the institutional positions of power. In Wisconsin, he also already brought that suit. And another Trump judge. Now, I'll give the Trump judge credit. He shot down all the abstention. That's the other lame excuse that judges use, the federal court system, to run away from responsibility, to abdicate accountability is abstention doctrines. There's like eight of them. I mean, it's an absurd number of them. I've had to adjudicate tons of them. There was one called Rooker Feldman that was preposterous for 40 years. I helped get it reversed at the Supreme Court finally, but there's a long story about that one. It was a Wesley Snipes civil rights case where the judge put them all in, put the whole kitchen sink in. If it's not this abstention, it's that abstention. But if it's not that abstention, it's the one over there. And if it's not that, it's the fourth one. I mean, tells you what a crock these excuses are. Judges who believe their own rhetoric. That's why the other thing, my problem with a lot of when lawyers believe standing straightforwardly, they're telling me they haven't reviewed the history of standing. Definitely Elector's Clause context, they hadn't reviewed Elector's Clause, but they're telling me they believe their lectures in law school. It's like, okay, all right. I mean, that's just not how judges actually make their decisions, because that's where I love. There's a great field of thought out there that's a data in law. And what they do is they use statistical analysis of cases to say, is this really predictive or not? If something is pretextual rather than causative, then you should see a certain pattern in the data. Standing is one of the worst at where it's not predictive at all. Now, if you put in the politics, then it becomes predictive. But standing is a doctrine based on fact patterns, not predictive at all. So that's where it is.
Now, Cleopatra's asking pretty much the same question to someone else before. I know the answer. There's no recourse against the Supreme Court not taking this up. Total immunity.
Correct. Now you have to go, because they invented that doctrine too, by the way. The whole point of the Constitution was that we were no longer, the idea of sovereign immunity comes from the idea that because the king is anointed by God, he can do no wrong. So you can't sue the king because God has blessed every action he's done, the divine right of kings. Our whole country was founded in opposition to that principle. I mean, Thomas Paine brilliantly said, if you really think that God anointed these people as kings, just take a look at their kids. It was a great, you know, commentary on, you know, the certain family intermarriage patterns with royalty. That's where immunity comes from. Courts just invented it. And again, where do you see the common pattern? You'll see the actual application of these doctrines where they're wanting to preserve political capital to not offend other institutional sources of power. They almost never exercise their limitations when it means whacking a little guy. And what is Trump just doesn't have enough institutional support to get Supreme Court support. That doesn't mean the door is closed completely. We can get into how some doors still may be open.
Okay. Now, we've discussed the Insurrection Act in a previous stream, so I don't want to get back into that.
I'll just briefly point out, folks, there's exceptions they wrote in so that you cannot use the military to deal with an election context in almost any way, shape, or form.
Okay, and we've got, I'm just going to bring up a couple of chats here. Now, one other thing. We are 15,973 people at my viewing here. Hit the like button if you haven't remembered yet, because oftentimes people forget that you should give the video a thumbs up. Unless you don't like what we're saying, in which case, give it a thumbs down and let me know what it is that you don't like about what we're saying. Let's see how fast we can get that number to explode like we did last week. Let me bring this one off so I can talk about this. Okay, so Trump's recourse.
The advantage is, so the Electoral College will meet tomorrow. This suit was intended to stop that, and several other ones were. And so then the question is, what next? So first, there's still always the possibility of state legislators sending their own electors to Congress. That's really what happened in 1876. But ultimately, the next big decision maker, now there's going to be, he has a Wisconsin federal case challenging on what Wisconsin did on the same grounds as the Texas suit. That's going up to the Seventh Circuit, headed to the Supreme Court. The Pennsylvania one is already up at the Supreme Court. There is a Georgia election contest case filed that's now pending before the Georgia Supreme Court. Because get this, a judge gets assigned to the election. And that Georgia election contest, people praised across the board, even people who are critics of Trump, as being the best possible election contest brought. I thought that was a worthy compliment. It's massively documented and substantiated. So what does the Georgia courts do? First, they don't even assign the right judge to it. There's a special protocol for election contests. They don't even assign the right one to it. And then the one that does get assigned to it just decides to delay it interminably. And they just not hear it on the quick time frame they're supposed to. That's what a crock our courts are exposing themselves as. One great utility, like I said, Trump is magic at undressing the emperor. He just keeps just pulling out the curtain and saying, look at that emperor. Look at that emperor. Look at that emperor.
Robert, my problem with that is I agree with you, but I think that that is only apparent to people who actually have their eyes open. And there's a great many people out there, more than I can even possibly imagine, who say, oh, baseless lawsuits. Look what happened in the courts. Of course, YouTube should remove certain videos. Why shouldn't they? I mean, there are people.
But that's, I think, always true. That's why the biblical proverb is let him who sees, it's some version thereof. I'm going to butcher it just like I did 23 for years. But but basically, you have, if you knock, it will be opened unto you. If you look, you will see it. But we've designed our systems and societies that does require that first act. For those people that are in the dark, there's not much you can do if you're stuck in Plato's cave, dance into the shadows. But you got to come out and look at the light if you're going to discover or create truth for others.
The one I have in my mind always is the Lord loves a working man. I think I got it from the movie The Jerk, first movie reference. And I've realized over time that it's not that the Lord loves a working man. It's that the working man tends to find their own solutions and therefore can attribute to the Lord what actually is the result of their own work, which is, when I finally understood what it meant, it was enlightening. So actually, there's one thing I don't understand. People are asking, can Texas boycott? Can they not give their electors? Would that do anything? Would that have any impact?
So, yeah, I mean, I've heard different proposals. I heard that and then send more electors. The only limitation in the electors clause is the number of electors is limited as to who you can send. And in terms of the number that you can send, then if you want to make sure that their vote counts, you can go there. Now, I guess the question would be, there's really not a lot of rules for the Electoral College. They usually get together in the state legislatures. There's the limitations. They can't be a federal employee. In fact, by the way, courts have used that in the past, other governors have used it. Like in 1876, the governor of Oregon substituted out the Republican elector because he was a federal officer, and he substituted him with a Democratic elector. So, I mean, these kind of games have taken on forever. They did it in 1800 to Thomas Jefferson in New York. I think maybe New York didn't even get their electors in time. As a general rule, not sending electors isn't going to do much because you as long as 270 electors vote for Biden or vote for Trump. I mean, presumably vote. Now, here's the other thing. Theoretically, the electors can vote for whomever they want on Monday. So there's nothing what is some state laws that the Supreme Court said were constitutional in 2018. Some state laws punish you if you don't vote a certain way. Others claim your vote is immediately invalid if you vote against the way you were sent by there to vote for. But how that would actually work in practice is far from clear. How exactly would they replace them in time, so on and so forth. So given that let's presume that they meet on Monday. Now, purportedly, Trump electors are going to meet in various states and claim they met and voted for Trump, like at least in Nevada is the rumor. I don't know if that's true, but that is something they can do. I mean, what triggered the dispute in 1876 was a bunch of different people sent in different electors. So you had the canvassing boards from the states send in one set of electors, and you had the legislatures, or in some cases just other bodies, send in other electors. And the question was, how do you interpret it? What's intriguing is, in order to deal with all this, we have three provisions that are applicable. The Electoral Count Act of 1787, the 12th Amendment to the United States Constitution, and the 20th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which would only come into play if we still don't have a president after noon, January 20th, where Nancy Pelosi is getting her hair ready and getting her drinks going. So rides over to the White House. So technically, guess who the person is who decides to count and read who the electors are? The president of the Senate, who's the vice president of the United States, the current one, not the new one. So it has long been in sort of academic debate as to whether the vice president could just declare whatever electors he believes are the actual electors. It appears that the 12th Amendment gives him that non-reviewable power because it only it didn't have to list anyone. In fact, what happens is the Senate and the House get together in the same chamber, but only in an observational role, not in an actual powerful role. And the vice president comes up and says, he goes in alphabetical order. Here we have this many electors for this person from this state, and goes on and on. What stops him from, say, getting to Arizona and saying the 11 electors for Arizona are for Donald J. Trump for president? Theoretically, there's nothing. The House and the Senate don't have a vote on it at that point. They're just, he's supposed to read them out. That's how the Constitution reads. Now, there's an interpretation that says Congress could override him. There's an interpretation that the Supreme Court could get involved. But there's also an interpretation that that's not how the 12th Amendment was intended to read. So the in that at the time they wrote the 12th Amendment, they knew of that high probability because the vice president would have been the person to have decided for himself in a prior election. Because the first major dispute was 1800, where Jefferson and Burr tied, and then one, you know, Burr, and I mean that led to the duel that led to one of them dying, but not with Jefferson, with other people. So, you know, like I said, we've been through worse elections, folks. You know, and I don't think anybody's going to be shooting each other. Well, hopefully not at the end of this one. So the I don't think Kamala Harris and Pence are going to do a duel. But here's what I have no doubt about: if this was the roles were reversed. And this was Joe Biden for Barack Obama as vice president or Kamala Harris for Joe Biden as vice president. Do we have any doubts that she would try to exercise this power? Now, do I think Pence will? Pence is the guy who, when Trump was under pressure in Access Hollywood, was basically hoping that Trump would step down so he could be the nominee. Didn't come to his defense at all. Pence is the one who helped push Flynn out the door. Pence is the one who cut the deal to get Ecuador to give up Julian Assange. So people don't realize this about Pence. Pence endorsed Ted Cruz, not Donald Trump, in Indiana. You know, the Trump chose him because of a certain appearance and because he appealed to the evangelical base, not because he's a Trumpist. And he just strikes me as almost all these establishment Republican types are weak-kneed and weak-backboned. They go into that back. They're like the British fighting us. You know, they come marching down the little road, and then they're shocked when everybody's shooting them from the sides. Like, that's not proper. You know, good luck with that. That's who Pence is. So the but theoretically, Pence could do that. Pence has that power. And people should be aware of it, because I guarantee you, roles reversed, Democrats there in the future, they're going to be exercising that power unless we clarify these rules down the road. The next step is that theoretically, the assumption was that you would have a dispute between, you would have multiple states, multiple electors coming in. But when he reads off, say, 11 for Arizona, a House member can, under the Electoral Count Act, a House member can then object. If a senator joins him, then both chambers have to go back and convene for 2 hours in debate and come back and say whether they sustain the objection or not. Now, there's a question about the constitutionality of the Electoral Count Act because of the 12th Amendment. The 12th Amendment says if there's a contested election where you neither candidate has a majority, then the House votes by state delegation. My view is the question of whether an election is contested should be decided in the same manner. Otherwise, you completely gut the 12th Amendment. If you get to say, well, no, the whole Congress is going to get to decide whether or not an election is contested, then you effectively negate the 12th Amendment because you can circumvent it always by playing that game. So my view is that part of the Electoral Count Act, and there's a second reason on the Electoral Count Act. Can the Electoral Count Act prohibit future Congresses? Because this will be the new House and new Senate, but the same vice president forming. Can this new Congress be bound by a prior Congress's laws, especially as to matters like the 12th Amendment and the Electors Clause? My view is they can't. But just as in terms of historical practice, this is what they've not followed that path. Historical practice is they do the House member, House and Senate get together. Now, if you go back and read 1876, it was a crazy fight. The House was filibustering, you know, forever to try to stop things in the Senate. I mean, every procedural shin, you had to really memorize your Robert's Rules of Order. You know, I mean, it was that kind of craziness and insanity that took place for months. It was on 48, and that was back when Inauguration Day was for the president was in March. And they were 48 hours away from no president before they folded. But if a senator joins them, then they have 2 hours of debate. The next question is, do both houses have to vote? Aside from the constitutional question of whether it should be a House voting by state delegation, the next question is, do both the House and the Senate have to approve the objection, or do both of them have to overrule the objection for the electors to count? That's also an undecided question. because I'll read some of the descriptions by leading legal scholars of our Electoral Count Act, of how they describe it. Quote, a monstrosity, quote, amounting to an impenetrable maze, quote, opaque, quote, contorted, quote, impossible to understand. That's from leading legal scholars' interpretation of the law that's going to govern this process.
It is going to, I mean, the more I hear about what appears to be just fundamental divide, and there seems to be more divide among the elected officials arising as time goes on. Like when Texas filed, and then a number of 12 or whatever, 20 other states joined, and then 120, what are the, I don't even know.
126 House members.
Then you realize like it's no longer people being quiet about it. It's not Texas doing this alone. There's a lot of people now who are either, you know, feeling empowered to speak out or are being convinced as the process marches along. It's an amazing thing where I can really see something like this happening where
I was for it back for Bush v. Gore, because at least what I like about this part of the process, by the way, I'll discuss tomorrow with People's Pundit on What Are the Odds, which is on at 2 p.m. on Eastern time, why it was genius of Trump politically to do what he did because of what you just said. How he converted this story into a very different story just by the Texas suit, regardless of the Supreme Court outcome. The worst thing, by the way, that could have happened to Trump would have been for the Supreme Court to take it and then shoot him down on the merits. That's where all these liberals are all happy. Oh, there's this sort of snobbish legal mindset that was so excited about seeing it dismissed. I'm like, that wasn't Trump's worst possible outcome by a long mile. But there's some genius politically to what he did, because there was almost no downside the way way this turned out. But yeah, no question. The other politically, it would be, if Republicans had an IQ over 50 that were in positions of power, this would be the smart move. And it was fight for Trump all the way through. Both Republican senators should run on this, say, I'm going to object because I'm not going to allow a fraudulent election to occur. So they get Trump, they put Trump on the ballot in Georgia for the runoff. Then they would actually have a chance to win. And then when they get there, if they lose because Pelosi doesn't allow the Democrats in the House to breach. And they interpret it to mean that just the House votes. Okay, fine. Then Pelosi stole the White House from Trump with Biden. That is a good narrative for Republicans and a good narrative for Trump, aside from people not liking that outcome. But at least create that. I mean, why not at least force that to happen if you think that's what's going to ultimately occur? But yes, they can debate it. They can debate it for 2 hours. There's an argument that if either House doesn't sustain the, my view is if both the Senate and the House don't both overrule the objection and sustain the electors, then my view is if there's enough, if that reduces the total, if there's enough of those votes on enough states that there's less than 270 for either one, and I get there's an argument about what the majority is in that context, but I believe it's based on the Constitution that number is 538 is a hard number. Then that it should go to the House to vote by state delegation. Because that was what the 12th Amendment said. Here's our roadmap if we ever get into a contested presidential election. The House will vote by state delegation. The new House members, the same House members you voted for in the same election. And of course, that happens to favor Trump, which is why they won't let it go there, or they'll do everything possible to avoid it. But that's, and that can happen all the way up until January 20th. So the Trump has remedies. The big question is, it's clear the courts are not going to come to his aid. It's unlikely state legislatures will, though they still have about 12 hours to take action. Otherwise, it's going to be up to Congress. But up until the fat lady doesn't sing until noon on January 20th. And
you've reminded me actually of one question that I wanted to ask. Alito and Thomas were dissenting in the Texas decision, I didn't understand from their dissent. Were they saying we would have not denied standing, but we would have dismissed? Or were they saying we should not have denied standing and I'm not pronouncing on the substance?
I took it more of the latter. I think that Alito was signaling that he was not going to give emergency adjunctive relief. And I think he was doing Trump a favor by explaining that. And it was he's really signaling to Trump, nobody up here is going to help. And that, you know, maybe me and Thomas and I might have in a different world, but all your three appointees aren't helping. And I think that's what that was meant. It was meant to be it was another reason to bring this case. It was, we need to know now whether the Supreme Court's going to help or not. Because if they're not going to help, we need to shift focus to Congress. Because it's clear the state legislators are, you know, too discombobulated to do anything. And now it's clear the Supreme Court's not going to come to our aid. And that was essential, or the Trump team aid. I shouldn't necessarily use the word our. In that context. But now Congress can. And Congress was always the ultimate remedy, the ultimate arbiter. Congress certifies the electors. Now, there is still a role for governors. Governors can choose not to certify the electors going up, because there's part of the certification process of electors that's the governor's. In fact, here's another thing with the Electoral Count Act. There was always going to be a problem, even if the state legislatures took independent action and set their own certificates of electors up, because the Electoral Count Act says that the electors from the what's certified by the governor are binding. Now, there's an argument that that provision, too, is unconstitutional. And there's an argument that Pence, as vice president, as president of the Senate, could be the sole arbiter of that. It's wild the way this can go, because the reason why I wanted the Supreme Court to get involved is I thought that was a cleaner roadmap. Let the court make the right decision to figure out, okay, this should go to the House, this should go to state legislatures, or hey, you know what, this was just fine, it's done. They're running for cover and hiding under the blankets, like a 3-year-old hearing a storm outside, was disappointing in that sense. But the utility is these are the political branches. The political branches in Congress have plenty of remedy. House members are already going to object. And I think why people have asked me, what can I do if I want to see this process go through the constitutional process? Well, and people have been very conscientious about that. It's reach out to United States senators. You can reach out to your United. If you want this to get some hearing someplace, since no court will allow it, since no executive branch state official will give an audit of the vote, of the ballot, of the mail-in procedures, of the machines, then by golly, at least let's get it for 2 hours in the House and the Senate. And you can at least get that if you just get one senator to join. There's already plenty of House members. I might know a few that are definitely going to object. That's a guarantee. And by the way, there were House members that were willing to object in 2016, 2012, 2004, 2000. This is not new. And going back to governor certification disputes, that happened in Hawaii in 1960. So this is not some like crazy thing out of the blue. There are way, but the idea that the Georgia governor or Arizona governor is going to step into the breach, not happening. A Democrat would if the roles were reversed, but neither one of those guys are. Those guys, you know, their spine is made of literally of jello. So it's going to go up to Congress. But people can reach out to their senator and reach out to any senator and say, look, I want a fair hearing. The senator doesn't have to commit. I know a lot of the senators don't like a lot of the unique allegations, shall we say, that like Sidney Powell and the Kraken suits and others have raised. There was always a legal problem with that, by the way. Think about it. If it's private companies and foreign countries doing bad, then guess who's off the hook? The states are, right? Then you lose your electors contest challenge, because it isn't the states doing something AWOL. It's private actors. And that was the other problem with that claim that couldn't be explained until after the Texas suit was filed so people could see it. But there's a lot of senators that don't like any of that stuff. So I think a pitch to the senators is, look, we just want a fair hearing. None of the courts gave anybody a hearing.
Man. And now, actually, if I may not, some will accuse you of spinning the SCOTUS decision. The argument is that by having dismissed it summarily without even granting standing, they didn't pronounce on the substance of it. So it's almost easier to weaponize politically to say, we can't go to the courts. They didn't dismiss on the substance. They dismissed on standing. And this is now where we have standing. That's going to be your way of framing it. Some people will call it spin. Others will call it framing.
It's reality. I mean, hey, the court didn't have to do that, but that's what they did. So, I mean, and I think senators can hear, you have 75 million Americans. You just had 126 members of the House join that claim. You had state legislators, including leading state legislators, also join the suit. Leading public interest foundations join the suit. You have over 80% of Trump voters who say Joe Biden was not legitimately elected. You have a crisis of confidence in our elections. All you have to do as a senator is just afford a hearing. I'm not asking you to commit to a vote, not asking you to do anything else. Just allow a hearing where at least some of the evidence and arguments can be heard. If we can have days and days of impeachment nonsense, we can have a few over Ukrainian gibberish. We can have 2 hours to discuss the presidential election for these states and allow the best people to make the best presentation and the best argument to both chambers of Congress. Let the country watch. Let the country participate. And then at least somewhere, someplace, somebody got heard by people with power to make a decision. And if they choose not to act on it, okay, that's their business. But as a senator, you're not having to embrace the whatever factual theory is there. You're just affording the opportunity for a hearing by objecting timely to each of these states. And that should be Arizona, Nevada, Georgia, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania should be the 6 states they object to certification to.
Okay, so it's going to be amazing to see what actually happens in reality. Forget the next steps. What's going to happen? Now, I guess next steps in terms of lawsuits, just I think you may have mentioned it, but give us the lay of the ground in terms of what we can look forward to, what we should expect, and what's not going to happen.
So the Arizona election contest brought by Kelly Ward and the campaign is in support of the campaign, the Arizona GOP is now before the U.S. Supreme Court. They're either going to take it or not. The Wisconsin denial on the there's a bunch of different Wisconsin cases. There's a Wisconsin case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court that could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court if they don't get favorable remedy. They also have a federal court case out of Wisconsin that's up to the Seventh Circuit heading to the U.S. Supreme Court. There are cases out of Michigan heading to the Sixth Circuit and then likely to the U.S. Supreme Court. Cases out of Pennsylvania currently pending before the U.S. Supreme Court. Multiple. I think they have 3 or 4 now from Pennsylvania. The Georgia case up before the Georgia Supreme Court might go back to the trial court for adjudication of the election contest, then back up probably to the Georgia Supreme Court. And ultimately, likely all of these cases will go up probably to the U.S. Supreme Court. The 4 Kraken cases were all dismissed last week. In Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and Georgia, they have all appealed to the they've asked for, I think, expedited appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, actually. I don't think that will be granted. I think they'll end up at each of the circuits, which is the 11th Circuit, 6th Circuit, 7th Circuit, and 9th Circuit. I think they're going to have a hard time getting remedy. The stronger cases and claims come from the president and those allied with him. And those are, the Supreme Court wasn't going to take this case that had 126 congressmen, 20 states representing 100 million people, high, well-regarded attorney generals, a bunch of state legislators from the states at issue, including the state majority leaders, House speakers, and major prominent state senators and others, major public interest foundations, and the president himself. It's not likely they're going to take any other case. And I think that's what Alito was. I think he signaled that not to be harsh. I think he signaled that to say there's not remedy up here. You need to look elsewhere.
Okay. Now, one thing that I wanted to talk about, we've talked about packing the courts and we've talked about in previous streams about how the SCOTUS should, you know, have an incentive to uphold the integrity of the courts. Now that I've seen this and people are this decision and this, what some would might call an abdication of responsibility, even if they were going to dismiss it, to do it properly and not on a pure technicality that doesn't address the legitimate issues. I get the impression, you know, these judges are there for, they're appointed for life. What do they care if they pack the court? They're not going to lose their job. They might have a diluted voice on the bench. What do they care at the end of the day if they pack the court? Just more people who are tenured for life, who suck at the teat of the taxpaying citizenry. Do you get the impression that they just don't care, actually, if the SCOTUS is going to get packed in a Democrat presidency?
My view is that the only person actually committed to originalism up there and textualism who would be bothered by court packing just as a matter of principle would be Thomas. There's a great documentary on him called Created Equal. I'm going to do a little review of it for our Locals Board subscribers and show you the critical role of life experience that documentary details. And, you know, why is Thomas the only guy who even cares enough to try? And Alito occasionally will be there. But it depends all on the issue with the others. I mean, this was an embarrassing outcome of Gorsuch, Kavanaugh, and Barrett. They should have at least said something. To say nothing, to sort of publicly stab Trump in the back the way they did, it may not have surprised Trump, but that's another story. It would have surprised them 2 months ago, because it was told that Kavanaugh and Barrett were intimately familiar with how the Elector's Clause worked, because they were part of the ones raising that as the issue for Bush v. Gore. But this is what the Federalist Society is like. So I think they would care to a degree. They want a Federalist Society majority up there. So that's a pro-corporate, pro-business, pro-government for the most part. Where they'll be good is they'll be pro-church, and they'll be pro-self-defense. But beyond that, you know, think of kind of the royal class that like to do fox hunting in old England, right? They care about the Anglican Church. They don't want anybody interfering with their fox hunting. But the rest of it, you know, they don't protect the little fella very often. Now, Thomas, all he cares about, honestly, is originalism. So wherever it goes, he'll go there. But I think he would be the only one. He would be disturbed on grounds of principle. The others would be disturbed as a matter of power, but they're doing a mighty peculiar job of defending that power by making it as easy as possible for Democrats to be able to pack the court. Now, I think even if I'll get into more detail tomorrow on the People's Pundit show on the political analysis side, but I think even if Republicans lost both seats and Democrats seized the Senate, Manchin and others have no interest in packing the court or stacking the Senate. So the Democrats need they need to have 55, 56 Senate seats to achieve that. And they also needed a lot more House seats. There's about 20 House members that won't go along with that. So they're barely holding on. So the combination of those elections will make it very hard for the dramatic things, including amnesty, to take place. If amnesty happens, it'll be because Republicans help make it happen, not because of Democratic votes or Democratic majorities.
All right. Now I'm just bringing this super chat up because it's an interesting question that we might not get into tonight. Any chance a broadcast license can be reviewed and revoked for lying to the public and shielding them from, you know, information. I went over this a little bit at the beginning, the censorship of what was actually deleted and unable to be shared on Twitter 3 weeks ago is now mainstream news.
I mean, it was the biggest big media, big tech, well, just media suppression of a major scandal story during the middle of a presidential election of a major candidate in our history. We've really never seen anything like it. And now it's revealed the scope and scale of it is what's shocking. Like, everybody kind of knew that at some level something was there, but not to the degree. And look at how bad Barr looks. And this is what, you know, the reason why I've argued with QAnon, all the rest. My view was Trump's great limitation was that he did not have enough people who shared his ideas and populist ideas in positions of institutional influence. And that included even the media, places like Fox and whatnot. And so that he was appointing people around him who were eager, who didn't have his back, they couldn't wait to stab him in the back. He started to figure this out later on, but he didn't. But it was a problem from day one. Anybody that was loyal got taken out, whether it was Steve Bannon or Julian Assange, and who was an outside supporter in what he was doing, whether it was General Flynn, of course, and a wide range of other people. The problem now, you see it with Barr. I mean, how bad is Barr's legacy going to be? So now, first he covers up Spygate with Durham, and he covered up everything related to the vice president's son being under criminal investigation, and he failed to do a meaningful investigation into voter fraud.
Well, I know.
So, I mean, this is embarrassing.
And publicly goes and gives an interview on the Associated Press where he makes, you know, what are not helpful comments to, you know, the Trump.
It's not true because he hasn't investigated it. And so it's just embarrassing. He has torched his reputation. But it was one of the reasons, like a lot of the Q stuff and other stuff that was out there kept saying, don't worry about all of these people. They're really secretly for Trump. And I understand that there was a mixture of opinion out there. I'm not trying to take a shot at all the Q folks. I'm just saying it was one reason why I didn't like aspects of it. It tended to promote a vision that said Trump was in control when, in fact, all these people around him were betraying him. And it's why he would be a lot stronger 4 years from now, frankly, because he could build the institutional support that Andrew Jackson did that made Jacksonian America possible. He's not going to be able. It's going to be hard for him to get that in 4 weeks.
Well, the problem is there's a lot of people who don't share your optimism that in 4 years they're going to get any more of a fair election. It's going to be 10 times worse given.
Well, that,
other stuff, which
you
I won't
use make. That 4 year intermediary to build independent tech platforms, independent media networks, and also changes in the law, with referendums, with initiatives, with recalls, with legislative reform. Start at the grassroots level, the local level, the city level, the county level, the state level. Change how elections are done. Remember, almost all elections are done at the smallest level, the city or the county. You can change it right there. You can change it with rules and regulations you put in on how the county counts votes, how they calculate votes, how they allow monitors. You can change it at the local, at the smallest local level. And that's really where power reform and revolution should start anyway. And there's been much more absurd propositions. If you're Fidel Castro and you're hanging out with 70 of your buddies up in the mountains counting sheep, and you think you're going to take over and overthrow a whole government with supported by the most powerful government of the world, and then you're going to govern for 60 years, you can hate Fidel Castro, but that's an extraordinary achievement. And what he did was patently irrational. The reason why Trump changed things is because he believes things that aren't rational to believe. The system relies upon people believing they have no power to change it. Even when you think about it rationally, you think there's no reason for me to believe I'm going to change anything. But in fact, if you overcome that belief, that by itself, Scott Adams calls it framing, Nelson Mandela called it being the captain of his own soul and the master of his own fate, quoting the poem, then you're able to change the world. And that's how change happens. Change happens by doing irrational things in the belief that you can achieve it. And that's how it actually becomes rational to achieve it.
It's fascinating. It's amazing. Now, I want to... I can't get the super chat anymore. Beto says, no matter what the Beto is B-I-T-O with a cute cat avatar, says, no matter what the outcome, do you think this is the script for an amazing movie?
I still say we're in the latter stages of the second act, and maybe I'll be surprised. And it would be great if Congress decides to take bold action, or I think it would be great. Half the country would be very unhappy. Congress takes action and puts and actually goes to the House vote by state delegation for contested elections. You know, I would like to see that protocol at least go through part of the procedure, so we establish it as precedent for future utility. But even if that doesn't occur, and this is, I still say we're in the towards the latter stage of the second act, not the third act. And the second act is only dramatic and fun if you're in a crisis. Frankly, it's when you think there's no hope. Why does the human narrative need that part of the story? You have to, like, if you tell it, there's a good another movie reference, Fat Man, could have been a great like Santa Claus movie. I always wanted like a Santa Claus revenge movie. Santa Claus goes out and like shoots people and stuff. I thought that'd be cool. A different kind of Santa Claus, more of the old Norse Cinder Claus kind of tradition, from which he, you know, the god Odin coming in with his mighty hunting a reindeer for the winter solstice. But to have that sort of tradition. But the reason why the movie's not that great is because it doesn't really have three acts. You never feel a crisis in the second act. So there's something about the human need for narrative. David Mamet, Three Uses of the Knife, first book reference. Brilliant. The neurological need for narrative and the architecture of the human brain. It's in our neurochemicals. There's something about that we need the crisis to actually have the drama that attracts us to the story. So, you know, that I see this as just act two, and act three is, Return of the Jedi.
And you know, what's funny is when I watched freaking Paw Patrol, the reason why Paw Patrol is so boring is because there's never actually any meaningful strife. There's never any actual meaningful discord. Even when the aliens invade and, you know, the pets or the Paw Patrol thinks that they're bad, everyone ends up being friends. And it misses that clash. But I do think
a great book on the psychology of fairy tales that says the reason why kids don't like happy fairy tales is it doesn't relate to their own experiences, and they need something to deal and process with their own emotions, good and bad. That's why they love the Grimm fairy tales. That's the fairy tales kids love. That's why they're the most popular, most famous. Think about it. I mean, there's stories about baking kids and eating them as cookies. I mean, you know, these are not sweetheart stories, but they're the ones the little 5-year-old wants to hear. It's because it's the neurological need for narrative. We need to be part of a story that has some crisis to be able to overcome to make it meaningful. You know, what is faith without doubt? And that's the nature of it.
Scott Adams said something, an interesting reference from before. He said, you know, one of his predictions was that there's going to be two presidents. And I was listening to, I think it was Tim Pool. But now that I think about it more and more, when Trump, if he leaves office, or if he doesn't, he's going to have Secret Service. He's going to have certain lingering things that will carry out after his presidency. He also might just have 75 million people who regard him as a president. What type of meaningful clash on a political level can actually endure after January 21?
Trump's going to be the shadow real president. in a lot of in the views of his supporters. And I hope he does do this. He's talking about having his own rally on Inauguration Day. So the to kickstart 2024 because he knows he'll get higher ratings and more views than Biden's inauguration if it goes that path. So the and for people out there that like are down or like, oh, there's no hope. I can tell you from personal experience, it's not true about Trump. So the Trump is entirely optimistic and idealistic. He sees all this as he sees every obstacle as something to get around or get over. He never sees it as, oh, golly gee, I got to quit now, go home. The world is over. We couldn't win this. It's finished. It's done. They're going to crush me. He never has that perspective. If you read any story about him being angry and bitter, totally false. Totally false. He's very energized and very engaged. And it's perfectly set up. I mean, he has more credibility for challenging and contesting this election than any president since Andrew Jackson. And that turned out to have a nice second act.
Okay, now let me see here. We're going to keep this to under 2 hours for technical reasons as well. Eric Hundley, who rips these, I can get them ripped a lot faster if they're 1 minute under 2 hours as opposed to 1 minute over. Is there anything else we need to talk about in terms of the update status? I think we've covered it thoroughly with Texas and where we're going.
I think there are election law reform ideas that people are propounding. There does need to be massive election, a legal team dedicated to this from a populist constitutionalist perspective, not just a Democratic or a Republican establishment perspective. And going through some of the themes of the people from the locals board, some of the sort of it was questions about, you know, why you should have hope. I think we've addressed that, how SCOTUS really works. I was talking about that with Alito. In other words, you know, this was a decision they discussed internally. And basically, Alito got the tea leaves and realized Trump didn't have more than two justices with him. So the signal was, rather than have you lose 7-2 on the substance, just let you know there's no relief up here. So you got to go elsewhere. I think he was being fair and Thomas were being fair. Thomas was the one guy who was willing to take a stand and say something. He was always that guy. He's my favorite justice for many reasons, but which I'll go into when I do that little locals film review. And I think the other one was this one we'll skip for another time. People were asking about secession. This is why the Supreme Court should be paying attention. This is why they're so out of touch. We have 75 million people saying take the case, 100 million citizens through their attorney general saying take the case, over 20 states, over 126 congressmen representing over 75 million people saying take the case, state legislators representing 50 million plus people saying take the case. Then you take the case. But to Alito's credit, maybe realized, okay, all of Trump's supposed allies are going to betray him, so we better signal otherwise. But that was the disappointing part of it. But what happens is you get people talking about secession, like Alan West was. There's no legal or constitutional way that I see to secede. You can go back to Calhoun. Calhoun had theories of contract that related to it. That didn't work out so well. So that's all I got to say about that. As a practical matter, I don't see how that functions. Now, of course, Democrats might be happy to have Republicans secede. They might be sure Texas secede. So then we can really run the country or the rest of the country. But I don't see that as practical.
No, but and anybody who says that, and I'm not, this is not a judgmental, it might be judgmental in that it's appreciative. Anybody who says that doesn't appreciate how the country works, how food works, how agriculture works. Like it's this right. Idea that New York
is interdependent economically and functionally.
No. Okay. Now, why has someone asked this, and it's not the first time I've seen it. Why hasn't Kamala resigned her seat yet? People are thinking that this means something.
That she's busy doing what Barack Obama did. So the as soon as Barack Obama got elected, what does he do? He always understands he learned his politics in Chicago. And so he learned the first thing you do is you protect your base. You make sure you're not vulnerable at your core area of support, something Blagojevich forgot by screwing over his own father-in-law. But the Barack Obama didn't. As soon as Barack Obama got into power, I remember telling somebody before it happened, if Twitter was around, I would have had a great prediction. I said, you watch, Blago and Jesse Jr. will be politically marginalized within 6 months of Obama taking office. I was just, it didn't even take 6 months. Jesse Jr. was in prison and Blagojevich was in prison. So you got to give Barack some credit for that. People claim it was all coincidental. Okay. I shouldn't have been able to predict it then. But Kamala was tutored in the same way. She was taught by Willie Brown, a guy whose political skill I have great respect for. Don't necessarily agree with him ideologically or his moral compass, which might just go around and around and around, depending on where the dollars are and where the power is. But he's a brilliantly skilled tactician, Speaker of the House, Mayor of San Francisco, Kamala's friend, shall we say, even while he was married. That's where she learned her politics. So the first thing you do as getting elected vice president is you make sure to that the two senatorial replacements will be your proteges, will not be your substitute sources of power within your own state in California and within the Senate. So my view is she's holding her position until there's agreement about who will replace her. I don't think it's a coincidence that she's been sticking the knife. Well, put it this way, that someone is somehow sticking the knife into Feinstein. Kamala Harris and Feinstein have been hating each other for decades, at war with each other in San Francisco for decades. People can just research this about death penalty, other issues. She wants Feinstein out, and she wants to choose both of her Senate replacements so they feel loyal to her. I experienced this, that even after she was gone from the attorney general's office, she made sure the people that replaced her administratively, not the elected official, but underneath them, were her people because they were loyal to her. They were people who behaved in accord with her political interest. And by the way, they helped protect her. They helped cover up some major scandals. That's what I think is going on there. She's not holding on to the Senate seat because she thinks Trump will be made president by January 20th. She's doing it because she wants to decide and dictate her replacement.
Okay, perfect. Let me see if I can get another couple of these questions. Let me get a couple of super chat questions that I took pictures of. Just before we wind this up, Supreme Court justice can, this was not a super chat, but it was Stephen Tibbetts says a Supreme Court justice can be removed if they violate their oath. None of these Supreme Court justices are being removed for anything, Robert, right?
I mean, you can impeach them. So back at the beginning, but that's, that'd be the House and the Senate. My own view is I don't support impeachment on grounds of their substantive votes, even when it's absconding from their what I consider their duties and obligations. I think it has to be extraordinary criminal malfeasance or other conduct like that. So now, but at the beginning, by the way, the courts used to give advisory guidance all the time. To give you an idea of how nonsense standing is as a doctrine, they used to give advisory opinions all the time. And they're in the English courts in the beginning of the American courts. What it was is our courts were so overtly political. The Federalists controlled the courts, and the young Republicans under Thomas Jefferson were coming up into power, that they weaponized the courts to completely attack them. And they would do political lectures, including Supreme Court justices doing trials like Samuel Chase would do political lectures from the bench. And so when Chase got impeached and then they passed the Judiciary Act of 1802, that sent the message to the courts, no more overt politics. You got to hide it instead. I think impeachment should be limited to cases where it's extraordinary criminal misconduct. And it's just a power that's likely to be abused, as we saw with President Trump, if we don't apply strict standards to it.
And people are saying, you know, Trump should pardon Assange and Snowden. We've talked about this. If he's going to do it, when does it have to happen by? Oh, and sorry, what are you smoking? Someone asked that question also in a super chat. What's a cigar? It looks like a Cohiba.
Oh, it's a Quai d'Orsay, which is after the part of Paris. It's a Cuban cigar that's a special limited edition made that's hard to come by. It's very good.
Okay. What was the question I just asked? Totally senile. What did I just ask 2 seconds ago? Someone's got to remind me in the chat. What was the question I just asked?
I did forget. I was going to the locals' questions. I think you okay, don't forget it.
Best path forward, Trump sweeps the country in rally after rally, driving support for 2022. Initiatives for convention on the states, wholesale constitution amendment, and bypass. Oh, I'm just reading this too fast. But best path forward.
I understand that idea. The thing with the new constitutional convention is you got to be real careful where that goes. So, you know, it could just as easily get rid of a lot of rights and be usurped. So the if you read Unruly Americans, great book, it's about how my ancestors had to fight long and hard, or our ancestors, but literally my great-great-grandfathers had to fight long and hard to get a Bill of Rights added to it because it wasn't originally there. So the I think that's the limitation to a constitutional convention. But I think we can have – I think people are looking for extreme remedies because they have extreme distrust of the system. But I think there are still remedies within the system that are easily achievable. much more so than people think. I mean, the other way to think about it is with all the big tech, big money, big media, censorship, suppression, and manipulation of this election and the crazy rules that they got away with this time, they still barely won.
Yeah.
So that's a testament to the strength of constitutional populist reformism.
You're an optimist. You see it as a testament to the strength, and other people see it as a testament to the will for corruption and the tolerance of corruption. But not to be the cynic, I was asking about Trump pardoning Assange and Snowden. What would be the time frame? As of when can he pardon? And can anybody block the pardon? I mean, we saw Sullivan's half motivation in his decision that the pardon is not all powerful. But as of when, up until when, and can anyone? Isn't that interesting
about advisory opinions? Talk about standing in advisory opinions. What's a 43-page moot dismissal opinion about? These are the same judges and the same legal scholars and the same legal advisors that would say, oh, standing's a serious constitutional doctrine and you shouldn't be giving advisory opinions. In between praising Sullivan giving a 43-page opinion about something he had no jurisdiction over anymore. So it was just preposterous.
That was painful to read. Painful.
I said, like, you know, he might have cost you that bottle of whiskey, whatever it was, because he might have denied the motion to dismiss that nut job.
I'm thoroughly convinced he would have denied it. He said in his decision it was a close call, but I didn't, you know, effectively saying I didn't get to hear all the evidence. Had I heard all the evidence, it wouldn't be a close call anymore. Nuts. And, you know, between a two-line dismissal on standing in the Supreme Court and a 43-page diatribe of wasted time and space, the Supreme Court had a middle ground. But pardon. What are the limitations? Can he do it? And until when?
Oh, yeah. Up until January 20th. I think it's, you know, basically when Biden's inaugurated. I think it's 12:01 p.m. I think is usually when it is. Yeah. Think of Susan Rice's CYA email timeframe, who's now going to be back in the White House. Look at all these people that got rewarded. Susan Rice involved in massive unmasking, massive illegality. And now she's going to have a big position in the White House. But what she did is right before it was like 11:58. She's emailing herself about all the Spygate scandals to try to do CYA. So a pardon is under the same time limitations. So as long as you have the power of the presidency, you can issue a pardon. I wouldn't recommend up until the last minute, obviously. I hope he does do it. I hope he does it relatively soon. I think he'll wait to do it until he sees how all this shakes out. I think it will be probably the second week of January that we would see it. But I do hope he pardons. There's more public. The populist part of the Republican base and the Trump base, because a lot of them are independents, they're not even registered or consider themselves Republicans, do support pardoning Julian Assange. More controversy around Snowden, but I think both should be pardoned. And if anybody sees that, it should be Trump. And now that especially he realizes that Barr not only managed to suppress and slow play him on uncovering and exposing Spygate, while he sees many of the participants in Spygate not only rewarded in the private sector, but now getting back into positions of power under Biden with Susan Rice, I think he's even more motivated to thank. But then he sees that, in fact, he also covered up the fact that Biden was under federal criminal investigation related to these issues. Yeah. Hunter Biden, that is. I think and that Barr was part of keeping that secret while he was not investigating meaningfully voter fraud and saying, don't worry, it didn't happen. Publicly, when he hasn't had the time to meaningfully vet it by all evidence, I think there's a strong motivation for Trump to thank the deep state actors by. Remember, Barr hated the idea of any pardon for Assange or for Snowden. So thank Barr, thank the deep state, pardon Assange, pardon Snowden.
All right, and I think that might be the absolute perfect time to end this because we won't get into another question, another subject. We should, I mean, look, the thing is, I feel terrible. There's 16,000 people still watching. What we should do is a midweek stream. We were going to do one last Wednesday or Thursday, but with the news that came out of YouTube, we had to see how that played out in terms of what they were going to do because people think it's fun to poke the bear and stand up to censorship, but there's no good doing it if you end up losing your voice doing it. And so between poking the bear and jumping in the volcano is my analogy.
And I'll be over for the next hour or so at our locals board, vivabarneslaw.locals.com, and answering questions of any of the subscribers and whatnot. And the goal is just to encourage that, incentivize that, because we got to build better infrastructure that is economically viable as well as technologically viable to these alternatives when YouTube is doing the kind of censorship and suppression that they are.
And I'm going to rip this right now, get it up on Rumble. And Rumble is from my live stream with Chris Pavlovsky. They're working for live stream capabilities in 2021. Locals is as well. And I'm going to look for a streaming device so that we can actually stream to other platforms, just so we don't have certain limitations of discussion and discourse. So everybody, thank you very much. It's an amazing thing. We'll see what happens. This week should be another, every week is a big week. And now that we've covered the election stuff, maybe next discussion we can talk about non-election stuff, if anyone still has any interest in it. There is the Facebook antitrust suit. There is this other stuff. There's other stuff, but we will be keeping up with the election analysis. And we won't be discussing the hypotheticals, just the constitutional stuff and the legal stuff so that people can truly understand it.
We can leave with this. To quote Jesse Lewis Jackson, keep hope alive.
Everyone, have a good evening. Robert, stick around. We'll say our proper...